Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Current state on WKAR. Can you believe we're already in our fourth week of current state? It has flown. It has been a blur. I remember 4 weeks ago like it was 30 years ago. Amazing. What do you make of our new program? Let us know at currentstate@wkar.org. And while you're at it, include an idea for a story segment, okay? currentstate@wkar.org. We appreciate it. Democratic State Representative Andy Shore of Lansing is exactly 4 weeks into his first term representing the 68th District. That's 4 weeks to the day. It is the 68th, right?
It is.
It is so easy to confuse all of the districts. Okay, so we're off to a good start here. I got the district right. 4 weeks to the day, Andy was sworn in. Current state's gradually making its way through the list of Lansing area state reps and senators, and it's a pleasure to welcome Andy Shore to Current State. How are you?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
And we thank you for coming by. I feel like I'd be remiss in my duties if we didn't address the state chairman situation. Your party is considering a new state chairman. Do you support a change?
You know, I support exploring a change. I think it's always good for the democratic process, good for the party to have people who are willing to step up and take the mantle of leadership. We've got a leader who's been there for 18 years in Mark Brewer, who's done some things good and some things bad. And, you know, there's always going to be, you know, positives and negatives over 18 years. We've got a gentleman named Lon Johnson, who ran for the House, who was a fantastic candidate in a marginal seat, who's interested in taking the mantle of leadership. I think it's great that we're going to have this discussion. I think it's healthy for the party.
If you had to vote today, would you be inclined to vote for Mr. Johnson or retain Mark Brewer?
Luckily, we don't have to vote today. I have not had a chance to meet Mr. Johnson, and I'm going to take the time that I have to make that decision. You know, honestly, I'm spending more time trying to get my office ready and work on the legislative stuff, but I do have some time, and I'll take some time to make that decision.
A reporter's biggest weapon is the word if.
If.
You know, if you could change one thing, what would it be? That's when you know you're having a conversation with a reporter.
That's true.
You're certainly aware of the case against Mark Brewer.
Sure.
You know, not enough Democrats elected in the state, doesn't enjoy the support of the UAW. Senator Levin and Senator Stabenow want to see a change. How much of this resonates with you?
Well, it's all very important. You know, yesterday alone, I got an email from the entire congressional delegation on why we need a change. I also got an email from Mr. Brewer on why we need to continue his leadership and all of his support. So it's all important. Although, you know, for me, I need to be able to judge for myself what's the best for the future of the party, and that will be, you know, my vote. I'm only one of many votes at the Democratic Convention. It's important to hear what our Democratic congressional leaders and party chairs and others believe, but I'll probably make that decision for myself based on the past and based on what I see as the future.
Are you willing to say whether Prop 2 was a bad idea, good idea? Are you glad that was on the ballot?
I think that it was necessary to be on the ballot because the unions have been attacked by the Republican majority and the governor over the last 2 years. I think that the unions felt that they needed to put something to the people, and I think that, you know, for them this was a very important issue and was necessary, and I think it was necessary for the voters of the state of Michigan to have a chance to decide on something. You know, the Republicans ran right to work. They ran more bills over the last 2 years than I've seen in my 15 years here attacking working people. So the unions needed to get something out in front of the people. So I think that I honor their decision that this is how they wanted to do it. You know, it wasn't successful, but it got a really good conversation out there, and I have no complaints or no criticisms.
Your first impressions of working at the Capitol in this capacity. I know you've spent a bunch of years at the Capitol as an aide, but now you got the big office. What's it like?
You know, it's great. It's great. I'm really enjoying it. You're right. I spent 7 years as a legislative staffer. I spent 5 or 6 years as an advocate on behalf of cities, all at the Capitol. I think that experience has gotten me a leg up to really, as I promised in the campaign, hit the ground running. And I have. You know, we've got bills introduced. I'm working on a whole variety of legislation. We're already helping out constituents and resolving situations. It's definitely different being, you know, the one to press the button as opposed to the aide advising a senator or a representative. But I'm really enjoying it. I've been itching to get going since the election, and now that we're starting, it's flying by. The days are flying by. They're packed, and I want to try and get as much done as I can in my 2-year term.
It won't surprise anyone if the governor proposes expanding Medicaid tomorrow night in his budget message. We're devoting a segment to it here tomorrow on Current State. I assume you support that.
I do. I do.
Can you explain why?
Well, as a county commissioner, you know, I saw a lot of this firsthand. I was the human services chair. I think that right now we've got too many people going to hospital ERs, which are costing a lot of money that the taxpayers pay for. You know, healthcare goes up. Accepting the expanded Medicaid dollars will be 400,000 to 600,000 new people covered under Medicaid. It's something that we should do in order to prevent our hospitals from having to pay more, that can help bring our healthcare down. The argument that you'll hear against it from Republicans mostly at this point, some Republicans, not all, is that there'll be a cost in 3 years because it goes from 100% federal pay to 90%.
Indeed.
The reality is we are spending so much more. It's something in the realm of $300 million per year in hospitals paying for uncompensated care. Well, we're paying for that. That's coming back on our health insurance. The reality is if we have to pay $30 million in 3 years, that is nothing like the $300 million that taxpayers are in essence having to eat because of the uncompensated care. I think we should accept it. There are at least 5 Republican governors nationwide that have accepted it. I put in a resolution about 2 or 3 weeks ago calling on the governor to accept it, and I get a whole series of co-sponsors. It hasn't been taken up in committee yet, and I guess we'll find out tomorrow. But I think we should accept it. I think it's our responsibility to accept it.
It's likely we'll learn more about the governor's road funding framework as well tomorrow night. So far, we know he favors some combination of a wholesale gas tax and hikes in vehicle registration fees. How do you feel about it?
Well, that was what he put out last year, and the Republicans in the Senate seem to have a variety of other ideas. I think that we need to do something with the roads. I think that how we get to 56 votes in the House and 20 votes in the Senate, there'll be a lot of discussion and debate over the next, you know, few months. I think that I'm open to a variety of proposals, but I also need to know that this is a bipartisan effort, that it's not just Democrats being expected to do this, you know, for the governor and, you know, a few Republicans joining in. I think that needs to be something that we all have a piece in, that we can all talk to our constituents about. I think that over the last 2 years, the middle class has taken a lot in terms of new tax burdens. There have been tax increases with the elimination of the child care credit, with the new senior pension tax.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because MERS News reported here just in the last day or two, there is some talk in the legislature about linking the governor's transportation revenue package to restoring the earned income tax credit. Can you confirm that that's being discussed?
I've heard the rumors myself. But I'm not part of the discussions. You know, I have not heard from the governor or any Republican leader that's on the table, but I've heard that is on the table. We do need to provide some relief to the middle class if we're going to ask them to fund the roads. You know, there are a lot of options. There are options where you cannot have a middle class tax increase, where you can, you know, there are a whole variety of options you can explore, as user fees, as truckers come in from out of state and use our roads. I think we need to have those who are beating up the roads pay for it without trying to burden the middle class, especially because they've taken such a new burden from the last 2 years. And I think people are going to realize that as April 15th comes.
But tying the transportation funding to the earned income tax credit seemed like a plausible bargain. The governor needs Democrats on road funding, and you would like to see the earned income tax credit bumped back up, correct?
I would.
Yeah.
I would. There are a variety of times. I mean, I wouldn't mind
seeing
the child care credit go back where it was. There are a variety of things that I think we should do. And it all could be tied to a discussion to transportation and road funding.
Now, the governor has also favored giving counties the authority to levy their own fees for their own roads. Do you like it? Your former county commissioner, do you like that idea for Ingham County?
Yeah, I do. I think that as a local option, it makes sense. I'd need to explore that more. I don't know that it should be a one county solution. I think that it could be a region solution. You know, if Ingham County increases the local sales tax, do we put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage to our border counties? Mm. You know, we could look at a tri-county solution, Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton. That way you don't have Lansing losing out on businesses to Delta Township or to, you know, DeWitt Township. So I think it could be a regional solution. And though there have been proposals like that in the past for arts and other things. So I support exploring something. I don't want to see it fail because, you know, one county doesn't want to do it and then put themselves at a competitive disadvantage to another county.
There are middle and working class people who are already fairly pinched, though, who could arguably use a break from higher taxes and fees. So that factors into your calculus as well.
That always factors in. I mean, people never want to pay more taxes and more fees, but because they've taken a new burden over the last 2 years, it is something to factor in. You know, you also have to remember that when you have roads with potholes and the snow isn't clear, you tend to break things more. You tend to break windshields and things. And there is a number out there, I don't have it on me, on what people are paying their mechanics and paying for the roads. So part of it is saying we're going to fix the roads so that you're not fixing your broken car.
Right.
So there's a piece of that too. But I do very seriously take into account the last 2 years of the increases for the middle class.
We're talking with State Rep. Andy Shore here on Current State on WKAR. Is there a Democrat you'd like to see run for governor next year?
You know, I'm curious to see who's got the drive and who's got the desire. Senator Whitmer would have been a great candidate and a great governor, and she is not running for laudable reasons, family reasons. I've got two little kids, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, so I can completely understand, and I think that's great that she took that into account first. There are lots of great candidates that I'm hearing. I'd like to see who actually comes out of the woodwork and says, yes, I'm ready to do it. I'm ready to put my life on hold to run for governor and raise the money and really get the Democratic message out. So I'm sure I could name a few people who I'd love to see, but I want to see who wants to put themselves forward first and then make that decision.
Mark Schauer.
I think Mark would be great.
Yeah, okay.
I think Mark would be great. I think Gary Peters would be great. I think, you know, there's a lot of names that are batted around, but I want to see who puts their name out there and who's got that desire and the drive.
Your party's convention is the 23rd of this month. It's coming right up. Do you expect some kind of breakthrough there or any kind of consensus even to start to take shape at the convention?
For governor?
Yeah.
I would hope so. I would hope that anybody who is interested will start to have that conversation at our different caucuses, at our different congressional district meetings, and start showing a presence. I don't think that anybody really needs to make the announcement until, you know, March or April. I think that gives them enough time to start doing the fundraising, to start gathering the support. You know, the election is not for another year and 3/4. But it would be nice for someone to start at least circulating an interest there at the convention to test the waters and see if they can gain the support.
Which Democrat would you most like to see run to replace Senator Whitmer in the 23rd?
Oh, Lord. You
know, you can include yourself if you want.
I'm not running. I'm not a good politician here because I'm supposed to say, I'm going to consider it, Mark. It's something I'm considering. But no, I'm not running. I want to serve my constituents for these 2 to 4 to 6 years. My wife would kill me if I started a campaign, in essence, a month from now.
Enough said.
Yeah. That's right. So I'm not running. I don't know. I think it's early yet. I've heard a few names. You know, Joan Bauer has clearly said that in the past that she may consider it. And, you know, I've heard a lot of names batted around. You always hear Barb Byram or Mark Meadows. And Barb, I think, is happy being a county clerk. She's doing a great job. And, you know, so I don't know. I want to see, again, I'm 4 weeks into the job, as you pointed out. It's 4 weeks to the day. And already I'm talking about 2014. I want to do the job, and I want to focus on, you know, who's running for Senate and governor and party chair later.
Noted. What do you think the odds are of Senator Whitmer running for another, you know, I mean, she's been batted around as Supreme Court and Attorney General.
You know, I think she'd be great for any of those jobs. But again, it's she's got to decide what can she do, how can she balance her family life with the needs of the state. And her desire to be in either of those jobs. I think she'd be great in either of those jobs. You know, she knows the Attorney General's office very well, and she'd be great in that scenario, and she needs to decide, can she take that, you know, 4 to 6 months and do that kind of a campaign?
Sure.
Same thing with the Supreme Court. You know, we could use some judges on the Supreme Court who have different philosophies than those who are there now.
Okay.
And I think she'd be great for either.
Okay. State Rep. Andy Shore, we appreciate you joining us on Current State.
I look forward to coming back.
Break a leg. Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Each Wednesday on our Neighbors in Action segment, we feature a person or an organization that's working to make the Lansing area a better place. This is a listener-generated segment, meaning that each week the person or organization we highlight will be nominated by you. And for this week's Neighbors in Action, we look more closely at the Lansing chapter of Reading is Fundamental, or RIF. RIF is a national program that encourages kids around the country to read. And with me in the studio to tell us about Lansing RIF is the director, Jennifer Otto. Welcome, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I think everybody's heard of Reading is Fundamental, or RIF, but let's go a little bit deeper. Tell us more about this specific, the nuts and bolts of the work that you do.
Lansing RIF, or actually every RIF program, is a book distribution program. And the idea is that you get children to become a community of readers by providing them access to books that they want to read. So we have a lot of books for the kids to choose from that they get for free, and they get to pick the one they want most of all and bring it home. And that's the basic core of what RIF is.
What ages are we talking about here?
In the Lansing schools, and we've been in the school district for about 36 years, we go from pre-primary this year until 8th grade. Up until this year, it's been pre-primary until 10th grade, but we've had some funding excitements in the past year.
I can see that. We'll get to that in just a second. When does pre-primary start? What age is that?
Pre-primary kids, maybe 3 to 5 years old.
Okay. And how many do you give out over the course of a year?
We give out between 30,000 and 40,000 books over the course of a year. And in fact, Lansing RIF, over our 36 years, have given out going close to 1.5 million books.
Wow. What are some of the titles that are you're giving out this year, right now?
We try to make a nice balance between the really hot, popular titles and really good titles, and some of those are hot and popular, too. We give out a lot of Captain Underpants, but we give out books by Walter Dean Myers, which are books about kids facing real situations in places like Lansing, Michigan. We give out picture books from Naked Mole Rat Gets Dressed, one of my new favorites, to old-fashioned ones like Henny Penny. And we usually have a couple thousand titles on at one time.
Captain Underpants, Naked Mole Rat.
Yeah, you see a theme? Authors know
you
what
said
kids
it.
Want.
Yeah, I didn't have to say it. You said it. I love when that happens. Tell us about the kids that you serve, their needs, their issues.
The kids in the Lansing School District are, as we serve through them through 8th grade, are all part of the RIF program. And in the Lansing School District, there's a great many kids at risk. Part of the reason is that many families with more money have taken their kids outside of the district for schools of choice, leaving it increasingly a more difficult situation in the city of Lansing. We know that there are kids in the Lansing School District whose only books at home have come from the RIF program. And in fact, some we've been there so long that we have volunteers now who were RIF kids as children, and they've said as much to us.
How about that? Wow. 36 years, you say, in Lansing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you conduct a survey, too, of the kids, and sometimes you get some interesting comments.
We
back
do. A few years ago, we started RIF in the high schools, which is very unusual. Generally, literacy programs are targeted toward the early ages as you get more bang for your buck to catch a kid really early. But we felt that students, especially in the transition from middle school to high school, were in a very difficult and dicey kind of period, and that if they had something as positive and familiar to them as RIF that they've been having since preschool or kindergarten, it might be good for them. So the first year we did ninth grade, we did a survey of the students and asked them how they liked it. We surveyed the teachers as well, and of course it was overwhelmingly positive. But the one answer that sticks with us the most, and this was an anonymous survey, we don't know the child, we don't know the book, but the child wrote, "This book explains me."
That is profound. This was a ninth grader?
This was a ninth grader.
Wow.
We know that at that age, one book can make a difference, and we like to think that we have.
Early childhood education is a huge discussion right now amongst policymakers. Does that stand to impact your program somehow? Reading is fundamental. Have you explored that?
I don't know that it's going to affect Lansing RIF very much, other than the fact that we did many years ago go back and pick up the pre-primary classes in the district. Many, many years ago, it must be 10 or 12 years ago, we started a birth through five book distribution program, which was then handed off to the Capital Area District Library. But the birth through five is a real targeted area for federal dollars, and it may be one of the reasons why national money isn't going to groups or programs like ours that serve school-age kids.
Okay. Now, for our listeners, tell us, how did you become involved in this cause?
I started off as a RIF volunteer. Our program, there's only one employee for Lansing RIF, and I'm it. I'm a part-time employee in the school district who has supported RIF so well all these years, hires me to do this. So I was a RIF mom. When my kids were in elementary school, I was a volunteer. I went over to the RIF office and picked out my books. I brought them to school and spread them all around and sat there all day giving books to kids. How great is that? And then when one of their coordinators retired and they had to get another one, I applied for the job and got it. And that was, 16, 17 years ago.
Before we run out of time, I do want to talk to you about the major hit that you took in terms of federal funding. What happened?
The National RIF Program lost its federal funding, and as a result, the grants that they gave local programs like ours went way down. And so our funding from National RIF went from $51,975 to $3,488.
Ouch. Wow.
And so this year's program, we scaled down. Instead of three books for every child pre-primary to 10th grade, we're giving two books to every child pre-primary through 8th grade, and have spent this year working really hard raising funds to put us into a secure position for next year.
Briefly, Jennifer, how do new volunteers get involved? How do people hearing this join you?
You can call me. My school district number is 517-755-4167. Look us up on Facebook, look for Lansing Reading is Fundamental RIF, or you can email me, jennifer.otto@lansingschools.net. We'd like your money, we'd like your volunteer services, we like everybody.
Jennifer Otto is Director of Lansing RIF, or Reading is Fundamental. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And if you'd like to nominate someone or an organization to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, each Wednesday, please send an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like. And today's suggestion of Lansing RIF came from listener Marilyn Wilson. Thank you, Marilyn. Coming up on the second half of our program, we talk arts and the impact on the economy. That's Current State coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on WKAR. We're glad you're here. When people think of Michigan's economy, their minds may not necessarily turn to art. However, a new report may have people giving the creative sector a second look. The nonprofit organization ArtServe released its second annual Creative State Michigan study last week. The report suggests that creative and cultural enterprises have a positive effect on the state's economy. This is something the Arts Council of Greater Lansing has long believed. The council's programs and initiatives focus on expanding Michigan's arts sector. And today we have Jennifer Goulet, who is president and CEO of ArtServe, on the phone, and Leslie Donaldson is in our studio. She is the executive director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing to discuss the value of arts and cultural organizations. Jennifer, hello.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Hello, Leslie.
Hi.
Here we are together on the radio. Isn't that great? Well, Leslie, tell us about the kinds of things you learned from this survey then.
Well, I think, you know, ArtServe Michigan has been a great leader for our state as far as advocating for the importance of arts and culture and the economic impact that the arts plays in our state and also here locally. And I know Jennifer's going to talk a little bit more specifics, but we have been working on a cultural economic development plan for our region since 2008, really focused on growing creative enterprise, attracting and retaining talent, and how can we use the arts as a means for creative placemaking.
And Jennifer, you want to weigh in on the survey?
Yeah,
what was your big takeaway?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the second report, which features data from 346 nonprofit arts and cultural organizations across the state, again reaffirmed the powerful economic impact that the nonprofit creative sector has in communities of all sizes across the state. This small and mighty group of organizations in fiscal year 2010 reported total expenditures of more than $500 million, $553.5 million spent and contributed in Michigan's economy. And that's for things like, rent, utilities, office supplies, includes the salaries. In fact, about $194 million of that expenditure total supported 22,335 jobs across Michigan's communities. And we think that's a pretty powerful statistic that really adds a new dimension to how we think about the powerful role of arts and culture as part of Michigan's economic strategy and the vibrancy of our communities to be the kind of places that attract and retain talent, business investment, tourists, and quite simply make them the kinds of places where we all want to live and explore.
Jennifer, do you still find, though, that a lot of people don't necessarily link the arts and economic stimulus?
Well, I think that that perception is changing, and we're certainly finding that this data and research, much of which we've gained through a national initiative that we're part of called the Cultural Data Project, which is capturing this kind of information annually, is helping us in shaping a new perspective for the economic impacts of the sector. One of the other amazing facts that was revealed in this year's report really further affirms the powerful growth sector opportunity that arts-related businesses play in Michigan's economy. A quick example, from 2006 to 2011, the number of arts-related jobs increased by 15%. To 85,656 jobs in Michigan. Arts-related businesses jumped by 65% to 28,072. And in the 1 year between 2010 and 2011, jobs went up by 11% and businesses increased by 16%. So when you kind of put those statistics in the context of that being a period of time when Michigan's economy was moving toward and through recession, we think it's pretty astounding that the creative economy is showing great potential And we're certainly very hopeful that state, you know, and local leadership will begin to look more carefully at how we can develop initiatives and support to help grow those kind of opportunities across our communities.
When we talk about creative industries, Leslie Donaldson, what are we talking about here? Museums? Music venues.
Oh,
what
absolutely.
Else?
We're looking at arts artists as well as arts and cultural nonprofit organizations. But in addition to that, we look at the creative industries as being those, you know, working in graphic design, web designers, print houses, advertising, and so on and so forth. Interestingly, in Greater Lansing, that aspect of the creative sector is also growing. When we worked with our consultants on the Cultural Economic Development Plan data, now this was back in 2008 and 2009, they used census data and some other tools that were available to us at the time. We found that the Greater Lansing creative sector is about 9% of the workforce and, again, continues to grow.
And now, tell us a little bit more, Leslie, about the Arts Council and the Cultural Economic Development Plan.
So we're really pleased to work with so many area businesses and our local municipal leaders on really trying to grow creative enterprise and really try to grow that creative workforce, also support our arts and cultural nonprofit organizations. But how can we use the arts as a means to attract and retain talent for other sectors that might be looking to attract jobs to the region? We found actually through this work that arts and humanities nonprofit organizations in Lansing and East Lansing is comparable to the number in a large city like Seattle. So per capita, we have quite a lot of, just in the arts and humanities nonprofit organizations alone, quite a significant sector. But then in addition to that, all of the graphic designers and those artists that are out there and they're trying to sell their work, make a living, and, you know, do a great job, you know, creating business for themselves here, that is also growing.
We're talking the arts and economic stimulus with Jennifer Goulet and Leslie Donaldson. It's so ironic that you should join us here this morning because an hour ago I got a tweet from the Grand Rapids Art Prize, and the tweet was, quote, 2013 will be our first sustainable year.
Yay!
So how about
Yay.
That? Yes. Of all the days to get that tweet, it was the day you were on. Art Prize, the Broad Art Museum, these have been huge shots in the arm, have they not?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Jennifer can probably talk a little bit more about Art Prize, but, you know, we have been working to support the opening of the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum here at MSU, which is going to serve as a cultural hub to the essentially the international community, and as a result, we expect a lot of visitors.
No doubt about it. Jennifer?
Well, and I think one of the fun things and kind of, again, conversation changers in this year's report is the degree to which arts and cultural destinations in Michigan are fueling state tourism revenues in that industry. In fiscal year 2011, our destinations generated more than $2 billion towards state tourism revenues. That was 16% of the state total revenues in that industry for that year. And what's even kind of more intriguing is that that was more than golf, boating and sailing, hunting and fishing, and hiking and biking combined. So a powerful player in attracting visitors to our communities across the state who are taking in the, you know, rich array of cultural resources and assets, historical landmarks that we have to offer. And we know statistically from national studies that have been done by our counterpart, Americans for the Arts, that cultural tourists tend to be the tourists that we want to attract. They tend to stay longer. They tend to spend more. They tend to come back to revisit places, and they tend to bring other people with them. So, you know, that's a pretty great success story for Michigan's tourism industry.
Jennifer.
And Art Prize is a fabulous example within the creative sector of how a community has really embraced and come together to celebrate the arts in a way that, you know, engages the business community and the artists and the arts and culture groups, the schools, and artists from across the globe, and attracting people to spend time having that experience and experiencing Grand Rapids and leaving dollars behind as they do it.
That is Jennifer Goulet, President and CEO of ArtServe, on the phone. Leslie Donaldson is in our current state studio. She is Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. We've been talking about the value of arts and cultural organizations. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Today, Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson is announcing a series of new initiatives to help the nearly 700,000 of the state's military veterans. Michigan has one of the nation's largest veteran populations, but ironically, one of the lowest benefits access rates. Current state's Kevin Lavery, himself a U.S. Navy veteran, went to learn more about the status of Michigan veterans. He spoke with another vet, Jason Allen. Allen is the senior deputy director of the Michigan Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. He says the state is trying to tailor its programs to the needs of very distinct groups of veterans.
In no particular order, one of the big areas is our more mature veterans, which would be like our parents and our grandparents that served in World War II in Korea. The utilization of benefits when the topic's called widow's pension and aid in attendance is we're 47th. This program has evolved and changed as the veterans have changed, and it is a very good baseline for a lot of our veterans that are in poverty. The next big area is our Vietnam-era veterans, and we have about 250,000 of them in the state of Michigan. And what this gets into is a term called presumptive diseases. And if you have diabetes or ALS or ischemic heart disease or cancer or Parkinson's, there are 17 of those different types of presumptive diseases. And Michigan ranks like number 48th in the utilization of those benefits. And then finally, as we all are struggling with as a country, how do we welcome our men and women home from Iraq and Afghanistan? In World War II, for every death, there were two survivors. In this conflict, there's 26. And we know that we've been having challenges with mental health issues. We know that we've been having challenges with even our own universities. And leadership from Michigan State was in this office very recently, trying to figure out how we can better customize programming and making sure that those men and women are aware for those benefits.
Michigan has one of the largest veteran populations per capita. You mentioned about 250,000 Vietnam-era veterans. There's really about 700,000 veterans in our state. And as you alluded to, we are dead last in terms of how frequently we access our benefits. How do we account for that?
This has been an area that did not get a lot of attention in the previous administrations. As the governor laid out in his State of the State so succinctly, we need to put some additional resources behind this, and then we also need to increase the awareness. We benefited over the years from a very robust economy, and as many of our listeners know, in 2000, I think we were number 7 or 8 as far as per capita income, and we got as low as about 41 or 42, and now we're in the mid-30s. As those benefits changed, people maybe became more aware of the types of benefits that they were able to utilize because they had very robust health care plans from the previous employers. And because we did not have a department that was focusing on this was probably the second big issue. We know that with certification, which we were able to get completed this month and was announced in the State of the State, Michigan as a state department will be able to track veterans, will be able to have a formal relationship with the Veterans Administration, and then we'll also be able to file claims. We've had great partnerships with counties and service organizations, but we also needed to get additional boots on the ground.
What's really the state's role in helping our wounded physically and mentally, emotionally readjust, and really also helping them navigate through this huge backlog of claims that's holding up the process?
Okay, the first issue is that we need to work as advocates. It's very unfortunate when you start talking about traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and there are so many men and women that have come back that are suffering from this, that it's okay to have problems. It's very valuable to sit down with people that are trained and certified in this area and support them during those transitions. We have seen this in every war that America has fought in. This is a more remarkable group of individuals because the amount of time in combat. 25% of the Michiganians served in World War II. Over 50% served in the Civil War. We have less than 3% serving in this current conflict. But their shoulders are much broader because of the time and commitment that they've had in these deployments. We know that our Michigan units are spending significant, much more time in conflict, in harm's way, than they did a previous generation ago.
There have been female soldiers deployed on the front lines. Officially, they are now eligible to see combat duty. Are we expecting, are we bracing for even more soldiers?
Okay, 17% of the people that are in the United States military are women. And we are so grateful for what the Michigan Women's Commission has done, adopting this as their major focus, coming up with recommendations under the leadership of Susie Avery, who is their executive director. They have focused on jobs. They have focused on the aspect of how to integrate them into society and really have made that their project for the last year and a half. They have done remarkable things in their resource. If you just Google Michigan Women's Commission, they have a whole litany of tools that help with this specific group of people coming back from combat. In addition to that, we know that when we've talked with Secretary Sinchecki, leadership at the Detroit VA and the Ann Arbor VA, that they're doing special programs, both on the counseling side and also at the different facilities, making sure that women issues are addressed.
Let's shift back over now to education for veterans. Michigan has a new program that places educational resources in 6 regions of the state, and each region has a veterans services officer that helps with that. Please explain how that works.
We know that the college system is very good at addressing the GI Bill. Today, in-state tuition, $1,400 a month, living expenses approximately, and $1,000 a semester for supplies. It's good for 8 semesters, and it is a very robust program. We know that the several hundred students that are on Michigan State's campus, I think right around 300, or the over 600 students that are at Lansing Community College, don't know that if you're back within the first 5 years of Iraq and Afghanistan, you generally qualify for 5 years free health care. We also know that about a third of them are qualifying for disabilities because of the amount of time in combat. That's good for several hundred dollars a month living expenses. When I've talked to officials at universities, they do not utilize the tax credits at their career planning and placement office. And in addition, most veterans get an additional year of college if they, under the VOW Act, for getting a disability rating. So what these college campus coordinators are going to be doing is they're going to give a leg up to those colleges that are acting as hosts. We have them spread from the Upper Peninsula to Southeast Michigan, and these 6 individuals will give us the counseling time to sit down with each one of those veterans to make sure that they're getting their full group of benefits.
How and when will our veterans be able to access them? And just as importantly, what can you say to them to reassure them that they can penetrate what may seem to them as a frustrating wall of bureaucracy?
The first thing that I would really encourage them to do is to take stock of what they can on the internet. Google Veterans Administration, Google our website under the state of Michigan /veterans. Item number 2 is then we know that on average you get a much better timeline and reduction of the bureaucratic hassles if they sit down and talk to a certified counselor. So head down to your county building. We have a great partnership with our county veteran service officers. Or they can Google the American Legion, the VFW, the AMVETS, the Purple Heart, to sit down with a counselor. They are trained in the bureaucracy, and they understand what it is and the processing and the filling out of the paperwork to make this a much more pleasant experience. We know that this is not going to be fixed overnight. When we've worked with our partnerships with the VA in Detroit, our partnerships with our VA in Ann Arbor, they're very concerned about the backlog. They've been able to move the state of Michigan's backlog down by several days each month. And is it perfect? No. But it is a process. If you use certified expertise, you're much more likely to get help.
Jason Allen is the Senior Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Thanks for having time for us today.
Kevin, thank you. Thank you to WKAR. We appreciate your interest in this issue.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Well, today marks a sad anniversary for Michigan beer drinkers. This week in 1985, the Stroh Brewery Company announced that it would close its brewery on Detroit's east side. Chairman Peter Stroh said that the facility was obsolete and it was demolished within a year. Many in the state mourned the brewery's loss, many of them WKAR employees. Detroit radio station WRIF's JJ and the Morning Crew released a tribute. This is a parody of Don Henley's Boys of Summer. It was called After the Brewery on Gratiot is Gone. And WKAR's Melissa Benmark asked Mike Stevens, the CEO and co-founder of Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids, about his memory of Stroh's closing and the beer renaissance that was about to begin in Michigan.
I graduated high school in 1986, so I was 17 years old, but not far away from beer, so it was. I do recall that. And, you know, I think it's more probably an end of an era, that of yellow domestic-style beers, but it also was then bringing in and introducing the beginning of a new era, which was this craft beer segment, which really did start in the state of Michigan around the mid-80s with guys like Larry Bell at Bell's Brewery.
How do you think the closing of Stroh's affected the craft beer movement?
With having a brewery in the state, I think the people of Michigan, you know, knew of beer production. They were a big, you know, they were a big brewery in this state. And I think as the industry started to come to light in terms of the craft beer industry, it was kind of an easy transition for, I think, the state of Michigan, because this is, after all, a state that, you know, had breweries existing in the state, had quite a few of them, actually. But, you know, its time was due, I guess. I mean, the industry of craft really started, I think, throughout the whole country. The earlier wave, you know, started in the 80s. You know, as you look at where we are now as a state, we have over 100 breweries operating in the state, and we're the fifth largest state in the entire country for numbers of breweries.
Do you remember the song?
The Stroh song?
The Don Henley send-up that the guys in Detroit did about after the brewery at Gratiot is gone?
Oh, yeah. That's right. I do. That's funny you just bringing it up. I totally forgot about that one.
That was Mike Stevens, CEO and co-founder of Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids, sharing his memories of the old Stroh's Brewery in Detroit, which filled its last can of beer 25 years ago this week. Memories of the sunset in Owosso, Michigan, right now, going through my brain. Tomorrow on Current State, Medicaid expansion, we visit with David Seaman of the Michigan Hospital Association. And State Senator Rick Jones also joins us for that segment. He is looking closely at the Medicaid expansion issue, and Mr. Seaman will also provide his perspective, and he is a proponent of that. Also tomorrow, Current State's first public poetry announcement. That is tomorrow here on Current State on WKAR. Peter Whorf is our program's executive producer. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Aaron Young, our engineer. You rock, Aaron. Go have a Stroh's. Also, big thanks to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Bill Richards, Kim Geiger. Thank you, one and all. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by City Pulse, which thanks the more than 12,000 readers who have voted in the 2013 Top of the Town contest. New issues on newsstands every Wednesday and online at lansingcitypulse.com.